You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape. This is This Week in Cardiology for January 15th, 2016. This week, I'm going to talk about long QT syndrome, exercise and atrial fibrillation, the athlete's heart, statins, and cardiac imaging. First up, long QT syndrome. I'm going to lead with this story because it's a story of overdiagnosis and overtreatment in a young patient population. This study came from the Mayo Clinic's Genetics Clinic. It was led by Dr. Michael Ackerman. They looked at more than 1,200 patients who presented to their clinic. Now, they reported that 45% or more than 500 patients who came to the clinic with a presumed diagnosis of long QT syndrome were dismissed from the clinic without that diagnosis, 45%. And of those who had confirmed long QT syndrome, nearly 1 in 4 of them had an ICD already implanted. But 78% of the implanted ICD patients did not meet a class 1 indication, and shockingly, nearly 40% had a contraindication to the device. Worse, complication rates in patients who had ICDs were high. These included inappropriate shocks, malfunction, infection, and of course, anxiety. Now, also valuable to read here is the accompanying editorial from Dr. Charles Barrow from the George Washington University, and he calls for intense re-education processes to go on with long QT syndrome. Overdiagnosis and overtreatment is a serious problem, but it's especially serious in young people and especially when it involves ICDs. And this study ties into the JAMA study last week, which showed the limits of genotype testing for channelopathies. I worry about overdiagnosis and overtreatment in this group of patients. Next up, exercise and AF. Last week, I told you about a study that showed potential benefits of exercise in obese patients with heart failure with preserved EF. This week, it's exercise and AF. Now, this was a small but well-done RCT from Norway published in CIRC that showed that high-intensity interval training may deliver improved symptom control and quality of life in patients with PAF. This included 51 patients, and half of them were randomized to a 3 times weekly interval training session. And the interval training sessions were 4 by 4 minutes at 85%, so significant amounts of exercise. I mean, you should try 4 minutes at 85%. It's a lot. But the intense exercise group got significant benefits. They had a decrease in AF frequency, a decreased severity of AF symptoms. They used ILRs to show that there was less atrial fibrillation, and of course, the exercise group had better VO2 measurements. Now, I don't want to overinterpret this small study over only a 12-week period, but I like it because it corroborates the findings of CardioFit, and CardioFit was an observational cohort study which associated gains in cardiovascular fitness with improved AF symptoms. But the more important thing to me here is what this says about lifestyle and AFib. I mean, think about what exercise does. Reduces stress, reduces inflammation, provides a sense of well-being, improves sleep. And these things are thought to be important in atrial fibrillation. So here we have a study that shows exercise, which delivers these things, improves AF. I think it's another piece of evidence linking lifestyle to AF. Next up is the evaluation of the athlete's heart. Now, this was a study from a group at Mass General and Cardiff University, and they studied 12 young elite rowers over a 3-year period. They found that exercise-induced cardiac remodeling occurs in stages. The early stage, about 3 months in, they noted increases in LV dilation, improved early diastolic filling, the E-wave portion of diastole, as well as increases in apical rotation, or what's called systolic twist. Now, that compares to late changes at 3 years, and here they found that there were slight increases in LV wall thickness, increased LV strain, and regression of that apical twisting. Now, the take-home and the key point of this finding is that duration of training may have a determinant in cardiac remodeling. which is, of course, important in assessing the athlete's heart. So in other words, if you have an athlete who presents with LV wall thickening, that may be less worrisome if the person's been training for years and years, and it may be more worrisome if the patient just started training. Here's another thing. There's this cumulative effect of training over years. Now, athletes know this, especially in cyclists. What you see in cyclists is they get stronger every year that they keep training, like this cumulative effect. Now, why would that be? And perhaps it's these late cardiac adaptations that were observed in this trial. I don't know, but I'm always looking for an explanation of why exactly athletes seem to get stronger year after year. Of course, up to a point when they get old, really old. Next is statins. So the Journal of the American College of Cardiology has published yet another study looking at statin eligibility in primary prevention. And of course, the controversy here is, what does that mean, statin eligibility? And so this study compared three different ways to determine statin eligibility. One way was the 2013 guideline risk-based method. Another was using trial entry criteria as statin eligibility. And the third was a hybrid approach using both trial-based and global risk prediction. So this was a Danish study that looked at 37,000 subjects, not patients, because they're primary prevention. They're not yet cardiac patients. So this group looked at what happened to these people over 5 years. Of course, in Denmark, there's a registry of cardiac events, and they looked at hard cardiac events such as non-fatal MI, cardiac death, and stroke. And then they compared it how these three different statin eligibility methods performed over the 5 year period. And they found that the 2013 guideline risk-based method best predicted events and while treating the fewest number of statin patients. So that's kind of an important finding, right? That this controversial risk-based method looked to be better performing than the others. Now, there's some limitations here. For one of the chief findings was that there was a negative 0.21 NRI, or net reclassification index. Now, I'm not sure how much that helps a regular doctor and regular patient decide on whether they want to take a pill for the next 5 to 10 years on the chance that it will reduce cardiac events. Another observation I have here is that the event rates were low, right? 6.8 to 11.2 was the range of events per 1,000 patient years. So when I see that, I figure about a 1%, that comes down to about a 1% incidence. And when I see that 1% incidence, I think about the 99% chance of nothing happening. So I'm not sure how much this helps the individual decision to take statin therapy. Next, finally, I want to close with a study on cardiac imaging. Now, previous studies, big studies, have shown that there's significant variation in the use of cardiac imaging, and there's a decline in cardiac imaging over the years. Now, at least to me, the fact that there's significant variation means that there must be some degree of inappropriate cardiac imaging. Somebody's wrong. At least as determined by a group of experts who've looked at the evidence. This was a study that was done by a McMaster's University group. It was published in Circ Outcomes, and they were interested in how different quality improvement techniques changed cardiac imaging ordering. And so what they did was a systematic review and meta-analysis of observational trials in one RCT, and they asked the question, how well did different quality improvement techniques reduce the ability, reduce the rarely appropriate cardiac imaging testing? And they found that the best way was when physician audits that had feedback. Now, they emphasized the component of feedback, but also effective was point-of-care decision tools. Now, the analysis wasn't perfect. As covered in the accompanying editorial, there may have been a significant Hawthorne effect. That is that when doctors know they're being observed in a trial, they may behave differently than in real life. And one piece of evidence for that was that in one of the RCTs included in this systematic review, The it was an echo imaging RCT, and the investigators of that found that the number of echo images went right back to pre-study levels after the study was over. So that's a pretty discouraging finding. Now, I've got two comments about this. One is that I've read the appropriate use criteria for imaging. I mean, I had this debate with a colleague about the use of imaging when the ECG was normal during a stress test. And I found the appropriate use criteria to be pretty soft, kind of a low bar. So if an institution has significant amounts of rarely appropriate images, that seems to be a problem to me. Second is, I know this is a difficult topic to talk about, but I believe that we can either fix this ourselves, or surely those who pay the bills will fix it for us. So that's it for this week in cardiology. I want to mention that to look at this podcast and other podcasts, you can go to www.medscape.com/TWIC. Until next week, this is John Mandrola from the heart.org on Medscape.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from the heart.org on Medscape.